Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. And today for this episode, I am joined with Grace Brown. How are you, Grace?
I'm good. Yeah.
It's a bit of a season hasn't started yet. It's that summer of cycling that is looming on us. We have a very important subject to talk about. And Grace, you flagged it to us. We've got Lauren Ricards with us, Professor Lauren Ricards, I should say. You're from La Trobe University. And we'll talk about climate change. It's a bit different on a cycling podcast, but there is a very big link. Thank you and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Christoph.
Grace, I know it's something that is close to your heart, heat and sun protection as well. And everything that goes around performing outdoors. You've been performing all your life, I guess, in sports outdoors. You're one of the first eyewitness, I would say, of that climate change. You probably have seen things change and how bad it can be.
Yeah, definitely. I think some of my least favorite races have been in extreme heat and just experiencing how the body is so affected by those conditions. And to be honest, it's a little bit scary to think that it's getting worse. Mm-hmm. We're not going in the right direction in terms of the climate. So I'm really interested to talk to Lauren today about this topic.
So, Lauren, can I call you Lauren, first of all?
Please do.
In France, it's all very, you know, professor. So I prefer ask Australian is much...
Lauren's good.
So, Lauren, in terms of climate change, what is your work? If you can summarize in an elevator chat, what you're working around?
We focus on the effects of climate change, including the potential effects, the risks, and what we can do to reduce those. So... our work complements that looks to reduce the greenhouse gas emissions that are increasing the concentrations that are causing the climatic change. And we look at what happens when those climatic changes collide with life on the planet, which means that we bring in a lot of other factors because climate change impacts don't fall from the sky. They always are a combination of things happening in society, in ecosystems, and those climatic factors.
I'm going to say this also straight and forward. Here, it's not that we believe in climate change. We know it's climate change that is happening. We're not going to even touch on the people that don't think it exists. So that's if you're feeling this way, you may skip to the next podcast or get angry listening to us. But Grace, it's something that touches you as well. You mentioned the extreme heat. So that's why you brought this subject to us for this podcast. Performing under the heat. Is it something that do you also work with athletes? Do you also work with people who are performing or have to perform under the heat and making sure that the physiology adapts as well?
Well, so I have a range of very smart colleagues who do that work with the athletes per se. I work, I guess, more at a systemic level. So really looking at a combination of things that are happening in conditions of extreme heat, in the wider conditions of climate change. So we collaborate across disciplines within La Trobe. So there's some amazing exercise physiologists there, for example. But I also work with a colleague, Greg Dingle, in the business school, who looks at the effects on sport events, on sport communities and sport societies. And then also we work with a range of partners, including, for example, front runners, who are doing a huge amount of fantastic work in this area to bring it to people's awareness.
Yeah, I think... when we talk about heat in sport, it's often spoken a lot about what the athlete has to do to adapt to conditions. Like for me, you know, we used to do heat training, the focus on like cooling during a race, pouring water on ourselves, hydration, like very self-centered, you know, singular person approaches. But I guess like speaking to you, I'm interested what do we need to start looking at from more of a systems point of view? Like if we're talking about, I don't know, the sports industry as a whole or like society around sport, fans, organisers, everything to start like adapting to the heat now?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. That's exactly the direction climate change forces us to think in. So, if you think of a race event just as something to sort of hook our minds on, as you rightly point to, it's not only the athletes that are experiencing, let's say, extreme heat. Obviously, they have particular exposure to that being out there, as well as, of course, generating all of the extra heat internally through exertion and trying to also perform at very, very high levels, not to mention trying to keep their brain fresh, their vision straight so they don't crash. And, you know, there's a whole range of very particular things for heat in athletes. But the thing is, with extreme heat or any climatic condition, it affects the entirety of that event and everything, you know, that makes that event happen. So that could be all the other groups. So it could be the organisers, the support teams, the spectators, the media. But it also affects other physical systems. So start with the bike. So tyres don't like really hot weather. Look at the road. Roads don't like really hot weather. They get sticky. But then you think about things like electricity. When we think about heat, you've mentioned already cooling, all of those cold chain things, whether it's the ice, the cold water, all of those rely on a functioning electricity system. If that's not working, then those responses are not there available to you. You can't have your ice slurry. You think about emergency services. They also hugely impacted, both in terms of spikes in demand, but also decreased capacity during extreme heat, particularly the sorts of long heat waves that we're working to, that we're, you know, moving towards. Then you think about, you know, broader things, you know, the internet systems. Everything is affected, and so it's not like you are dealing with a hot athlete in a situation that is normal. The entire situation is abnormal. And that's what keeps going. And
so in that sense, should events publicize their carbon footprint, knowing an event here is consuming so much carbon to be in place? Is that something that you want to be thrown into the public as well, so we can all have this reflection about events?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think everybody now has to start really reflecting on how they can reduce their carbon footprint as much as possible. At the same time, the work that we do is in recognition of the fact that even if we do manage to start turning around that emissions curve, start bringing down those atmospheric concentrations, we are looking at a worsening climate for decades to come. And the sorts of conditions that we've already seen at the kind of average global temperatures that we're at, so, you know, around 1.8, 1.92, as that moves up, as it will before it comes down, if we manage to get our mitigation policies happening, we are looking at radical destabilization of societal systems. And so absolutely reducing carbon footprints has to come first. But at the same time, that requires work. Work requires functioning systems. All of this has to happen. The sort of stuff we're talking about is like putting on your life jacket. Like, you really, really need to be doing that in order for us to achieve anything, including greenhouse gas mitigation. Just one quick thing I would say too is the carbon footprint idea is very useful at getting people to reflect on their position within systems. However, you know, it is really important to realise how, again, systemic, that word again, how systemic a lot of the production of emissions are. And what we're looking at are political solutions rather than, say, consumption solutions, lifestyle solutions at that individual level. We absolutely have to reduce consumption. We absolutely have to reduce them per capita. But that's not enough. We also need those big political decisions, you know, such as around fossil fuel extraction, for example, which is obviously topical when you think of the tour down under. They have to be, they're the big decisions.
Yeah. So most of our listeners are big cycling fans.
Yes.
And I think, yeah, for a lot of us, I'm a cycling fan included, and riding a bike, you know, is generally seen as good, you know, a good option for the planet, but these cycling events aren't necessarily, and the professional calendar, like athletes are, you know, taking international flights, like there's a lot of movement, but then also, you know, we're hosting events potentially in climate, you know, this January in Australia, we have some major cycling events that are often really hot. And I guess for our listeners, the question I want to ask is, like, how can professional cycling continue? How can we continue to enjoy this sport in a world that's getting hotter?
Well, if I pick up on your point that you made about the importance of cycling as a mode of transport, one thing I would advocate for, as a very keen cyclist myself, as a very amateur level, is the importance of connecting across to those broader worlds of cycling and really advocating for it as part of the solution. So obviously you have these elite events where, you know, it's sort of quite a different kettle of fish to your kind of rail trail type enjoyment. But nevertheless, I think there's a continuity there to say, you know, this is such an important mode of transport. And it's an important mode of transport under climate change, not only because it's low emissions, I won't say quite zero emissions, given that, you know, people need to eat, et cetera.
And you still need to make the bike as well.
You still need to make the bike, that's right. Yeah, that's right. The carbon.
Yeah, carbon is not that good for
this. Yeah, we might need to revisit though some of the names. But it's an excellent, probably, you know, the most efficient form of cycling when it comes down to it. It's transport, sorry. But also, it's a highly resilient one in the sense that, you know, you look at a lot of disaster situations that are emerging, and what's happening is you're having so public transport has disruptions, it's not working, major roads are blocked, these things are not working. There are many, many cases where cycling has been the way in which people get around in emergency situations.
Ding, 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 ding.
That's right, ding, ding. And you don't have to be an elite athlete.
Yeah.
But there's something there about encouraging kids, encouraging people to have a cycling-friendly society, cycling-friendly locations and places, that I think is a huge and quite unique contribution that the cycling industry can make to society that's very pro-climate change action. So that's one thing I would say. Then in terms of its actual practices, then it's about, you know, doing a bit of an audit on those and saying, well, hang on a second, why do we do that? Why do we fly there, and there when we could just go, you know, one place? Like, there's some major reorganisation that can occur in most industries, and I'm sure cycling's the same, where things have fallen into place through combinations of habit and convenience and all sorts of drivers that aren't necessarily that relevant or meaningful. So, yeah, for those in charge of international cycling calendar events, there's some questions to be asked, including around the seasonality of it. One of the things that we need to note is that, you know, what we think of as summer, those conditions are stretching. And so, you know, it's about understanding that the changing seasonality, the changing heat. And then, you know, clearly any major event, whether it's a music event or a cycling event, you know, they have massive issues around resource consumption and waste, and there's a lot of gains to be made there. And again, the role modelling is so, so important, as well as the material effects.
I saw the marathon, Paris Marathon has decided next year to not give bottles anymore, not give any recipient. You have to bring your own bottle and you can fill your own bottle while you're running, because there were so many waste on the marathon, which is, you know, there's nothing, you need nothing but a pair of shoes to run a marathon, but the wastage around the ravitaillement was awful. You mentioned, we talk about climate change, we always talk about heat, but there's also rain, there's also a lot of destruction. On the other side of the scale, it gets cooler and harsher winter, and today we talk about cycling, but if you follow a cycling calendar, you get hotter summer, but you get potentially wetter winters as well. So that changes as well your performance, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely right. And while heat is the sort of the core topic when we talk about climate change, because the average temperatures are going up and we're getting these more extreme heat events, the whole climate itself is becoming higher energy and more chaotic, and that means we're getting a lot greater volatility of all sorts, and really rapid transitions between them too. So Melbourneians are kind of a little bit experienced in this sort of thing.
In one day,
that's right. But, you know, that we talk about whiplash, hydroclimatic whiplash between floods and droughts back to floods. There's also a lot of energy in the air, the wind, so storm events. And these have enormous impacts, including just at a really basic level on road conditions, which, you know, has a particular consequence for cycling. So, and unfortunately, I've got some close family experience of this in that on a morning cycle after a storm, my dad, with a group of his mammals, the middle-aged men in cycling, they might have been a bit more than middle-aged, mm-hmm. but he hit a large stick which flipped up and jammed into his brakes, and he flipped, broke his neck, his spine in five places, and his femur. It was a very, very close call. He's still with us and still functioning well, but it was an extreme accident caused by a stick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously sticks have fallen from trees for a long time. But, you know, what we're talking about when we talk about these climatic hazards is a loading of the dice. The dice are loaded towards more storms, towards worse wind events, towards worse rain events, more intense rain, really, really short, sharp rain events, which causes these landslips and these really, really destructive of roads.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we take a short break, and then we come back. We carry on the chat about climate change. Don't go away. Welcome back to the second part of this podcast on SBS Cycling Podcast on SBS. Of course, talking about climate change. Grace, talk about your experience a little bit about, you know, you mentioned a little bit on in the first part of the podcast how hard it was under the heat. And but what is a heat training? No. What is it? Because you throw this word like, yeah, I was doing heat training. What is it?
Yeah, well,
how hard is it?
It's not pleasant at all. So there's a few ways that you can do it. You can either just in the environment, if it's hot outside, you can train in the heat. You can add extra clothing so that your body's not able to cool itself as effectively. Or as a lot of athletes do, training indoors, sometimes in a heat chamber, but sometimes just on a stationary bike with extra clothing on and without wind and, you know, the usual cooling of being outdoors, it becomes very sweaty very quickly. And, yeah, there's two reasons that athletes do this. And one is obviously to, you know, if they're going to compete in a hot environment, to adapt to that. But also it can have performance enhancing effects similar to altitude, because you're increasing your blood volume with the heat, as far as I understand it. It would be great if we had a physiologist on here.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you can have sort of some improvements in your performance because of that.
So it's like you're hitting your hand with a hammer and then you feel so good when you stop.
Yeah, exactly. You're like so used to the pain. Your body's been like stressed so that it overcompensates, so that once you're in a less stressful environment, you can perform easier. But yeah, it's particularly unpleasant.
Yeah,
I would say.
Horrible. You must have been daunting to do it. Yeah, every time you had to do it on your program, you were like, ah.
And you'll be like in this environment, say in a heat chamber, if we'll use that as an example, and they say, you know, pedal at this percentage of your max heart rate and just stay there, and you think, well, that's easy. But then the further you go along, the harder it is. Like your heart rate just wants to keep going up, your power is decreasing, and by the end, like, yeah, you just have to stop because it's like your impossible. Body's yeah. the going into overdrive.
Yeah, the equation doesn't work
yeah.
at some point.
Yeah.
Lauren, has there been events that you've watched on TV or watched as in real life where you went, we crossed the line here. We crossed the line on what's acceptable for the public, what's acceptable for the athletes. Is there a professor in you that look at some events, stages of the Tour de France, for example, and go, that's not good?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, most of the time it's those images of an athlete in, you know, obvious extreme distress. So whether it's, you know, in the Australian Open or whether it's, you know, seeing a cyclist. There was a cyclist that was vomiting quite a lot mm-hmm. in one of the Tour de France stages there. You know, that's where you really do wonder kind of like the rationality of the situation, and you just really hope that there are people monitoring that and really putting the athlete's well-being at the heart of it. I think there's increased awareness now that, you know, to do what those athletes do is not normal. It requires extreme training.
So
extreme training under supervision. Yeah. I don't think listeners should
don't do this at home yeah. without supervision.
but in terms of the reaction, what the politics and people in authority, what can be done now so we can help the system? Is there anything that are very simple actions in your eyes on an event, on different things like this, that could really act and have a very short benefit?
Well, so some sports are just making the most of the fact that, you know, we obviously have sort of diurnal temperature range, so it's cooler in the evenings and mornings, at least conventionally. So shifting the time of day, avoiding that kind of mid-afternoon heat in particular, and so that's why you're getting more nighttime events.
Cycling's particularly bad at this one. Yeah. It's always in the hottest part of the day that the...
Isn't Spain doing something like this? Like their Vuelta stages are later? Or is it just because they're just happy to work later?
I think that's the Spanish time.
More than just the concerns.
I don't think that it's for the athletes. And often, like in summer as well, because the days are longer, so yeah. the period of to like get the cool part of the day, you're getting earlier and earlier or later and later. And obviously, we can't compete in the dark. Mm-hmm. Also, that's a safety hazard. So, yeah, in my eyes, I see like the morning is probably the best time because there's a lag in the day heating up. But mm-hmm. yeah, it's quite a tricky solution, I think.
Absolutely, and those trade-offs, I think, really reminds me. A friend and I did the Larapinta Trail walk fairly recently, and we thought it was a luxury walk, but alas, we were woken at like 1:32 in the morning to get up, put on head torches and start walking to avoid the heat of the day to do your 30K.
Wow.
So, yeah, but it, you know, wasn't particularly safe. So
should it be, you know, like some sports have installed some concussion protocols, and the sports, and including cycling, are much better than it was 15, 20 years ago, or maybe just when you started. Should it be a protocol as well for heat that is clear? Because some of the, if you just take the Australian Open, sometimes the heat protocol is complex. You don't understand. You reach a temperature, but humidity is not here, and the shade, and it's quite a complex thing for the public to understand. Should it be a better assessment of it?
Yeah, look, it has to be science-based, I think. So as far as I understand it, the Union Cyclist International has a heat protocol, extreme heat protocol, which involves getting together the organisers, team representatives and other locals together to discuss how to manage an upcoming predicted heat event. However, it doesn't define what extreme heat is, and that's actually quite a complex thing. So best practice is to actually use what's called the wet bulb temperature index, and what that does is that takes into account other compounding factors, notably humidity, which means that lower temperatures can still have a very, very severe heat stress effect, as well as wind.
You take Hong Kong or Singapore as an example. Absolutely. 32 and absolutely horrible to perform that, outside.
Yeah, that's right. And the other thing about heat is that our bodies, roads, environments, we absorb it. And while, yes, typically nighttime temperatures are cooler and we tend to be able to expel some of that heat, so one of the biggest effects of climate change is actually increasing nighttime temperatures. What happens is that we are unable to expel all of it, so there's a residue. So we go into the next day already a little bit cooked. So then it requires less exposure at less extreme temperatures to still enter a heat stress zone. So there's a lot of factors to consider. So, okay, it's going to be, you know, below an extreme heat threshold on day five, but the previous four have been really hot. You need to take that day five very mm-hmm. seriously. And so these endurance events really have to take into account the fact that, yeah, we carry that heat in our bodies. And this is something that a lot of work sites, a lot of industries are looking at, how to, you know, and it's a tricky one because it almost requires them to reach into the domestic private lives of workers to say, okay, when you get home, mm-hmm. you need to hydrate and
wash your hands.
Not with beer.
And a cold shower.
Yeah. A cold shower. And you need to go to sleep and not play football mm-hmm. outside in the sun. And you need to sleep under air conditioning, which you might not be able to afford. You know, mm-hmm. like these are big things. And, you know, companies that dig things out of the ground are really facing some pretty
big challenges
mm-hmm. around extreme heat and workers, to which I think most are turning to robots instead.
Yeah. In terms of the athlete's point of view, for you, Grace, what we just talked about, does it need education for the athletes as well? When you start saying, oh, there's a heat protocol, we're not going to do this, this 2 days race is cancelled, we're playing, that disturbs the schedule. And the thing that a high-performance athlete hates the most, I guess,
is having
a schedule disturbed.
Is
there some education there?
When it's, like, affecting their health, I think then they're happy for it to be adapted. And
yeah, there's always one.
You mentioned, you know, there's like the UCI has these protocols around extreme weather that are ill-defined. And we see that a lot in practice, that you get to, like, I've been at a race that's been incredibly hot and seen competitors like falling off their bikes in heat stress. And the decision was then having to be negotiated amongst the teams rather than coming from the top. Mm-hmm. And it really should be more clear and more, I think, immediate, like putting they prioritize the where the money's coming from, not the health of the athletes, which is really frustrating. But
as an athlete, I'll come back to you again, Grace. Mm-hmm. As an athlete, when you started your career, you were probably checking on your app rain or sunshine. But do you think they're checking a lot more humidity, wind was always one, but like, do you go deeper into the data to understand what the weak racing can be ahead that you probably were 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think maybe not, like, they don't like to think too far ahead mm-hmm. generally, but the understanding that it's going to be hot, that humidity plays a role as well. Generally, the humidity is sort of more consistent than the heat. Like, if you're in a location that's humid, it's probably going to be humid every day.
Just not Melbourne.
just not Melbourne. but, yeah, that, like, cumulative effect, I think, as athletes, we really focused on, like, post-race cooling protocols so that, you know, we were having, like, an ice bath, a cold shower. There were, like, temperatures that we had to sleep in to recover. But still, even doing that, you can feel your body, like, carrying the heat for a long time, and definitely each day that goes by at a certain temperature, the worse you feel.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but ice bath is a good example. I've been long enough in that sport as a commentator to remember times where ice bath were not a thing.
Yep.
But now every team have got ice bath, let alone a bean or an inflatable one, or they have an ice solution. That's key, I guess, from your point of view as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I think society in general is becoming more and more reliant on the cold chain, as it's called, this supply chain of cold things. But as I said, it's very, very precarious. It itself is incredibly exposed and sensitive to climate change. So ideally, so if we flip for a moment to think about buildings, for example, that you might retreat into for your ice bath if you or to sleep.
If you're lucky.
We need to think about, for example, ways of designing buildings that cool them down, that don't rely on mechanical cooling. This idea that you just build these boxes, black boxes, you see so many of them without any eaves, that are going to rely 100% on air conditioning is just foolish. We really, really need, to use the rich repertoire we have of vernacular designs that allow air movement. Mm-hmm. There's so many different traditions around the world that have got very, very intelligent ways. So that's a sort of, I guess if we flip back to cycling, and obviously cyclists rely on buildings, but more broadly, it's about thinking about some of the simpler solutions too. So, so shady locations, for example, though of course in windy conditions you get trade-offs there with safety, but other ways of rather than, I guess what I'm trying to say is you can't just add ice. You can't just take today's cycling world and add ice and all's pretty. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work like that. Yeah. And we haven't even talked about some of the climate change effects like sea level rise. And I noticed that the Tour Down Under's got this nice long stretch to start with along a beach promenade there.
Mm.
That's highly threatened by sea level rise. Okay. So there's all sorts of things that we need to redesign and consider.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming into this podcast. It was quite an enlightening discussion, albeit it's a very complex subject. Thank you for coming.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.